Well, who could blame them? Bender and I found a rampway that spiraled upwards. No Whiteians followed us up from the lobby. I suspected they were so busy with other CDF forces that they forgot all about us. The rampway terminated at the roof. I stopped Bender just before we rose into view and crept up slowly to see three Whiteians sniping down the side of the building. I plugged two, and Bender got the other one.
"What now?"
sent Bender.
"Come with me,"
I sent. Your average Whiteian looks rather like a cross between a black bear and a large, angry flying squirrel. The Whiteians we shot looked like large, angry flying bear squirrels with rifles and the backs of their heads blown out. We crab-walked as quickly as possible to the edge of the roof. I motioned to Bender to go to one of the dead snipers. I took the one next to him.
"Get under it,"
I sent.
"What?"
Bender sent back. I motioned to other roofs.
"Other Whiteians on other roofs,"
I sent.
"Camouflage while I take them out." "What do I do?"
Bender sent.
"Watch the roof entrance, and don't let them do to us what we did to them,"
I sent. Bender grimaced and got under his dead Whiteian. I did the same and immediately regretted it. I don't know what a live Whiteian smells like, but a dead one smells positively fucking rank. Bender shifted and aimed at the door. I sent to Viveros, gave her an overhead view through the brain pal, and then started doing damage to other rooftop snipers. I got six on four different roofs before they began to figure out what was going on. Finally, I saw one train its weapon onto my roof. I gave it a love tap in the brain with my rifle and sent to Bender to ditch his corpse and clear the roof. We made it off a few seconds before the rockets hit. On the way down, we ran into the Whiteians I was expecting on our way up. The question of who was more surprised, us or them, was answered when Bender and I opened fire first and wheeled back to the closest building level. I pumped a few grenades down the ramp to give the Whiteians something to think about while Bender and I ran.
"What the hell do we do now?"
Bender yelled at me as we ran through the building level.
"Brain pal, you asshole,"
I sent, and turned a corner.
"You'll give us away."
I went to a glass wall and looked out. We were at least 30 meters up, too far to jump even with our enhanced bodies.
"Here they come,"
Bender sent. From behind us came the sound of what I suspected were some very angry Whiteians.
"Hide,"
I sent to Bender, trained my MP at the glass wall closest to me, and fired. The glass shattered, but didn't break. I grabbed what I would guess was a Whiteian chair and threw it out the window. Then I ducked into the cubicle next to Bender.
"What the hell?"
Bender sent.
"Now they're coming right for us."
"Wait," I sent.
"Stay down. Be ready to fire when I tell you. Automatic."
Four Whiteians turned the corner and carefully made their way towards the shattered wall pane. I heard them gargling to each other. I turned on the translation circuit.
"Went out the hole in the wall,"
one was saying to another as they approached the wall.
"Impossible,"
another said.
"It is too far down. They would die."
"I have seen them leap great distances,"
the first said.
"Perhaps they would survive."
"Even those," untranslatable, "cannot fall 130 deg,
unit of measurement,
and live,"
said the third, coming up on the first two.
"Those,"
untranslatable,
"eaters of,"
untranslatable,
"are still here somewhere."
"Did you see?"
untranslatable, probability, personal name,
"on the ramp. Those,"
untranslatable,
"tore it apart with their grenades,"
said the fourth.
"We came up the same ramp as you,"
said the third.
"Of course we saw
it.
Now quiet yourselves and search this area. If they are here, we will exact revenge on the,"
untranslatable,
"and celebrate it in service."
The fourth closed the gap between him and the third Whiteian, and reached out a great paw to it, as if in commiseration. All four were now conveniently standing in front of the gaping hole in the wall.
"Now,"
I sent to Bender, and opened fire. The Wyidians jerked like marionettes for a few seconds and then fell as the force of the bullet impacts pushed them back into the wall that wasn't there anymore. Bender and I waited a few seconds, then snuck back to the ramp. It was unoccupied except for the remains of untranslatable probability personal name, which smelled even worse than his dead sniper compatriots up on the roof. So far, the entire experience of the Wyid homeworld had been a real nasal treat, I had to say. We headed back down to the second floor and headed out the same way we had come in, passing by the four Wyidians whom we had helped out the window.
"This isn't really what I expected," Bender said,
gawking at the remains of the Wyidians as he passed.
"What did you expect?"
I asked.
"I don't rightly know," he replied.
"Well then how can it not be what you expected?" I said, and switched my brain pal to speak to Viveros.
"We're down," I sent.
"Come over here," Viveros sent, and sent her location information. "And bring Bender. You're not going to believe this." And as she said it, I heard it over the random fire and grenade booms. A low, guttural chant echoing through the buildings of the government center.
"This is what I told you about,"
Bender declared, almost joyously, as we cleared the final corner and began our descent into the natural amphitheater. In it, hundreds of Wyidians had assembled, chanting and swaying and waving clubs. Around it, dozens of CDF troops had staked out positions. If they opened fire, it would be a turkey shoot. I switched on my translation circuit again, but came up with nothing. Either the chants meant nothing, or they were using a dialect of Wyidian speech that colonial linguists hadn't figured out. I spotted Viveros and went to her.
"What's going on?"
I shouted to her, over the din.
"You tell me, Perry," she shouted back. "I'm just a spectator here."
She nodded over to her left, where Lieutenant Keyes was conferring with other officers.
"They're trying to figure out what we should do."
"Why hasn't anyone fired?"
Bender asked.
"Because they haven't fired on us," Vivero said. "Our orders were not to fire on civilians unless necessary. They appear to be civilians. They're all carrying clubs, but they haven't threatened us with them. They just wave them around while they chant. Therefore, it's not necessary to kill them. I think you'd be happy with that, Bender."
"I am happy about that,"
Bender said, and pointed, clearly entranced.
"Look, the one that's leading the congregation. He's the Fue, a religious leader. He's a Wyidian of great stature. He probably wrote the chant they're singing right now. Does anyone have a translation?"
"No," Vivero said. "They're not using a language we know. We have no idea what they're saying."
Bender stepped forward.
"It's a prayer for peace," he said. "It has to be. They must know what we've done to their planet. They can see what we're doing to their city. Any people to whom this has been done must be crying for it to cease."
"Oh, you are so full of shit," Vivero snapped. "You have no fucking clue what they're chanting about. They could be chanting about how they're going to rip off our heads and piss down our necks. They could be chanting for their dead. They could be singing their goddamn grocery list. We don't know. You don't know."
"You're wrong,"
Bender said.
"For 5 decades I was on the front lines of the battle for peace on Earth. I know when a people are ready for peace. I know when they're reaching out."
He pointed to the chanting Wyidians.
"These people are ready, Viveros. I can feel it, and I'm going to prove it to you."
Bender set down his MP and started towards the amphitheater.
"God damn it, Bender!"
Viveros yelled.
"Get back here now! That's an order!"
"I'm not just following orders anymore, Corporal!"
Bender yelled back, and then started to sprint.
"Shit!"
Viveros screamed and started after him. I grabbed for her and missed. By now, Lieutenant Keyes and the other officers looked up and saw Bender racing towards the Wyidians, Viveros chasing behind. I saw Keyes yell something and Viveros pull up suddenly. Keyes must have sent his order over the brain pal as well. If he had ordered Bender to stop, Bender ignored the command and continued his race to the Wyidians. Bender finally stopped at the lip of the amphitheater and stood there silently. Eventually, the Fue, the one leading the chant, noticed the sole human standing at the edge of his congregation and stopped his chanting. The congregation, confused, lost the chant and spent a minute or so muttering before noticing Bender as well and turned to face him. This was the moment Bender was waiting for. Bender must have spent the few moments, while the Wa'idians noticed his presence, composing what he was going to say and translating it into Wa'idian, because when he spoke he attempted their language, and by all professional accounts, did a reasonable job of it.
"My friends, my fellow searchers for peace," he began, reaching out to them with his hands curved in.
Data culled from the event would eventually show that no less than 40,000 tiny needle-like projectiles that Wa'idians call Abdgur struck Bender's body in the space of less than 1 second, shot from clubs which were not clubs at all, but traditional projectile weapons in the shape of a tree branch sacred to the Wa'idian people. Bender literally melted as each Abdgur sliver penetrated his unitard and his body, slicing away at the solidity of his form. Everyone agreed later that it was one of the most interesting deaths any of us had ever seen in person. Bender's body fell apart in a misty splash, and the CDF forces opened fire into the amphitheater. It was indeed a turkey shoot. Not a single Wa'idian made it out of the amphitheater or managed to kill or wound another CDF soldier other than Bender. It was over in less than a minute. Viveros waited for the ceasefire order, walked over to the puddle that was what was left of Bender, and started stamping in it furiously.
"How do you like your peace now, motherfucker?"
she cried, as Bender's liquefied organs stained the lower half of her legs.
"Bender was right, you know," Vivero said to me on the way back to the Modesto.
"About what?" I asked.
"About the CDF being used too fast and too much," Vivero said. "About it being easier to fight than to negotiate." She waved in the general direction of the Wa'idian home planet, which was receding behind us. "We didn't have to do this, you know. Knock these poor sons of bitches out of space and make it so they spend the next couple of decades starving and dying and killing each other. We didn't murder civilians today. Well, other than the ones that got Bender. But they'll spend a nice long time dying from disease and murdering each other because they can't do much of anything else. It's no less of a genocide. We just feel better about it because we'll be gone when it happens."
"You never agreed with Bender before," I said.
"That's not true," Vivero said. "I said that he didn't know shit and that his duty was to us, but I didn't say he was wrong. He should have listened to me. If he'd have followed his fucking orders, he'd be alive now. Instead, I'm scraping him off the bottom of my foot."
"He'd probably say he died for what he believed in," I said. Vivero snorted.
"Please," she said. "Bender died for Bender. Shit. Walking up to a bunch of people whose planet we just destroyed and acting like he was their friend? What an asshole. If I were one of them, I'd have shot him, too."
"Damn real live people getting in the way of peaceful ideals," I said. Vivero smiled.
"If Bender were really interested in peace instead of his own ego, he'd have done what I'm doing and what you should do, Perry," she said. "Follow orders. Stay alive. Make it through our term of infantry service. Join officer training and work our way up. Become the people who are giving the orders, not just following them. That's how we'll make peace when we can. And that's how I can live with just following orders. Because I know that one day, I'll make those orders change."
She leaned back, closed her eyes, and slept the rest of the way back to our ship. Luisa Viveros died 2 months later on a shithole ball of mud called Deep Water.
Our squad walked into a trap set in the natural catacombs below the Hani colony that we'd been ordered to clear out. In battle, we'd been herded into a cave chamber that had four additional tunnels feeding into it, all ringed with Hani infantry. Viveros ordered us back into our tunnel and began firing at its mouth, collapsing the tunnel and sealing it off from the chamber. Brain Pal data shows she then turned and began taking out the Hani. She didn't last long. The rest of the squad fought our way back to the surface, not an easy thing to do, considering how we'd been herded in the first place, but better than dying in an ambush. Viveros got a medal posthumously for bravery. I was promoted to corporal and given the squad. Viveros's cot and locker were given to a new guy named Whitford, who was decent enough as far as it went. The institution had replaced a cog, and I missed her. Chapter 11. Thomas died because of something he ate. What he ingested was so new the CDF didn't have a name for it yet. On a colony so new it also didn't have a name, merely an official designation. Colony 622, 47 Ursae Majoris. The CDF continuing to use Earth-based stellar designations for the same reason they continued to use a 24-hour clock and a 365-day year, because it was easiest to do it that way. As matter of standard operating procedure, new colonies transmit a daily compilation of all colony data into a skip drone, which then skips back to Phoenix so that the colonial government can keep tabs on colony matters. Colony 622 had sent drones since its landing 6 months earlier. Aside from the usual arguments, snafus, and scuffles that accompany any new colony founding, nothing of any note was reported, except for the fact that a local slime mold was gunking up damn near everything, popping up in machinery, computers, animal pens, and even colony living quarters. A genetic analysis of the material was sent back to Phoenix with the request that someone create a fungicide that would get the mold literally out of the colonists' hair. Blank skip drones started arriving immediately after that, with no information uploaded from the colony. Thomas and Susan were stationed on the Tucson, which was dispatched to investigate. The Tucson attempted to raise the colony from orbit. No luck. Visual targeting of the colony buildings showed no movement between buildings. No people, no animals, no nothing. The buildings themselves, however, didn't seem to be damaged. Thomas's platoon got the call for recon. The colony was covered with goo, a coating of slime mold several centimeters thick in some places. It dripped off power lines and was all over the communication equipment. This was good news. There was now a possibility that the mold had simply overwhelmed the equipment's transmission ability. This momentary burst of optimism was brought to an abrupt halt when Thomas's squad got to the animal pens to find all of the livestock dead and deeply decomposed thanks to the industrious work of the mold. They found the colonists shortly thereafter in much the same state. Nearly all of them, or what was left of them, were in or near their beds, the exceptions being families who were often found in children's rooms or the hallways leading to them, and the members of the colony working the graveyard shift who were found at or near their posts. Whatever hit, hit late and so fast that colonists simply didn't have time to react. Thomas suggested taking one of the corpses to the colony's medical quarters. He could perform a quick autopsy that might give some insight into what had killed the colonists. His squad leader gave assent, and Thomas and a squad mate hunkered over one of the more intact bodies. Thomas grabbed under the arms, and the squad mate took the legs. Thomas told his squad mate to lift on the count of three. He got to two when the slime mold rose up from the body and slapped him wetly on the face. He gasped in surprise. The slime mold slid into his mouth and down his throat. The rest of Thomas's squad immediately cued their suits to provide faceplates, and not a moment too soon, since in a matter of seconds slime mold leapt from every crack and crevice to attack. All over the colony, similar attacks were made nearly simultaneously. Six of Thomas's platoon mates also found themselves with a mouthful of slime mold. Thomas tried to pull the slime mold out of his mouth, but it slid further into his throat, blocking his airway, pushing into his lungs and down his esophagus into his stomach. Thomas sent via his brain pal that his squadmates should take him to the medical quarters, where they might be able to suction enough of the mold out of his body to allow him to breathe again. The smart blood meant they would have almost 15 minutes before Thomas began to suffer permanent brain damage. It was an excellent idea, and probably would have worked, had not the slime mold begun to excrete concentrated digestive acids into Thomas's lungs, eating him from the inside while he was still alive. Thomas's lungs began to dissolve immediately. He was dead from shock and asphyxiation minutes later. The six other platoon mates joined in his fate, the fate that had, everyone later agreed, also befallen the colonists. Thomas's platoon leader gave orders to leave Thomas and the other victims behind. The platoon retreated to the transport and made its way back to the Tucson. The transport was denied permission to dock. The platoon was let in by one in hard vacuum to kill whatever mold was still lingering on their suits, and then subjected to an intense external and internal decontamination process, which was every bit as painful as it sounds. Subsequent unmanned probes showed no survivors of Colony 622 anywhere, and that the slime mold, beyond possessing enough intelligence to mount two separate coordinated attacks, was nearly impervious to traditional weaponry. Bullets, grenades, and rockets only affected small portions, while leaving other portions unharmed. Flamethrowers fried up a top layer of slime mold, leaving layers underneath untouched. Beam weaponry slashed through the mold but did minimal overall damage. Research on the fungicide the colonists had requested had begun but was halted when it was determined that the slime mold was present almost everywhere on the planet. The amount of effort to locate another inhabitable planet was deemed less expensive than eradicating the slime mold on a global scale. Thomas's death was a reminder that not only don't we know what we're up against out here, sometimes we simply can't imagine what we're up against. Thomas made the mistake of assuming the enemy would be more like us than not. He was wrong. He died because of it. Conquering the universe was beginning to get to me. The unsettled feeling had begun at Gindal, where we ambushed Gindalian soldiers as they returned to their Ares, slashing their huge wings with beams and rockets that sent them tumbling and screeching down sheer 2,000-meter cliff faces. It had really started to affect me above Udaspri, as we donned inertia-dampening power packs to provide better control as we leapt from rock fragment to rock fragment in Udaspri's rings, playing hide-and-seek with the spider-like Vindi who had taken to hurling bits of the ring down to the planet below, plotting delicate, decaying orbits that aimed the falling debris directly on top of the human colony of Halford. By the time we arrived at Covabanda, I was ready to snap. It might have been because of the Covandu themselves, who in many respects were clones of the human race itself, bipedal, mammalian, extraordinarily gifted in artistic matters, particularly poetry and drama, fast-breeding and unusually aggressive when it came to the universe and their place in it. Humans and the Covandu frequently found themselves fighting for the same undeveloped real estate. Covabanda, in fact, had been a human colony before it had been a Covandu one, abandoned after a native virus had caused the settlers to grow unsightly additional limbs and homicidal additional personalities. The virus didn't even give the Covandu a headache. They moved right in. 63 years later, the colonials finally developed a vaccine and wanted the planet back. Unfortunately, the Covandu, again all too much like humans, weren't very much into the whole sharing thing. So in we went,
to do battle against the Kovandu, the tallest of whom is no more than 1 inch tall. The Kovandu are not so stupid as to launch their tiny little armies against humans 60 or 70 times their size, of course. First, they hit us with aircraft, long-range mortars, tanks, and other military equipment that might actually do some damage, and did. It's not easy to take out a 20-centimeter-long aircraft flying at several hundred clicks an hour. But you do what you can to make it difficult to use these options. We did this by landing in Kova Banda's main city's park, so any artillery that missed us hit their own people. And anyway, eventually you'll dispose of most of these annoyances. Our people used more care destroying Kovandu forces than they typically might, not only because they're smaller and require more attention to hit. There's also the matter that no one wants to have been killed by a 1-inch opponent. Eventually, however, you shoot down all the aircraft and take out all the tanks, and then you have to deal with the individual Kovandu themselves. So here's how you fight one. You step on him. You just bring your foot down, apply pressure, and it's done. As you're doing this, the Kovandu is firing his weapon at you and screaming at the top of his tiny little lungs, a squeak that you may just be able to hear. But it's useless. Your suit, designed to apply brakes on a human-scaled high-powered projectile, barely registers the bits of matter flung at your toes by a Kovandu. You barely register the crunch of the little being you've stomped. You spot another one, you do it again. We did this for hours as we waded through Kova Banda's main city, stopping every now and then to sight a rocket on a skyscraper 5 or 6 meters high and take it down with a single shot. Some of our platoon would spray a shotgun blast into a building instead, letting the individual shot, each big enough to take a Kovandu's head clean off, rattle through the building like mad pachinko balls. But mostly, it was about the stomping. Godzilla, the famous Japanese monster who had been undergoing his umpteenth revival as I left the Earth, would have felt right at home. I don't remember exactly when it was I began to cry and kick skyscrapers, but I had done it long enough and hard enough that when Alan was finally called over to retrieve me, Asshole was informing me that I had managed to break 3 toes. Alan walked me back to the city park we had landed in and had me sit down. As soon as I did, some Kovandu emerged from behind a boulder and aimed his weapon at my face. It felt like tiny grains of sand were plunking into my cheek. "God damn it!" I said, grabbed the Kovandu like a ball bearing and angrily flung him into a nearby skyscraper. He zoomed off, spinning in a flat arc, decelerated with a tiny thunk when he hit the building, and fell the 2 remaining meters to the ground. Any other Kovandu in the area apparently decided against assassination attempts. I turned to Alan.
"Don't you have a squad to pay attention to?" I asked.
He'd been promoted after his squad leader had had his face torn off by an angry Gendalian.
"I could ask you the same question," he said, and then shrugged. "They're fine. They have their orders, and there's no real opposition anymore. It's clean and sweep, and Tipton can handle the squad for that. Keyes told me to come hose you down and find out what the hell is wrong with you." "So what the hell is wrong with you?"
"Christ, Alan," I said. "I've just spent 3 hours stepping on intelligent beings like they were fucking bugs. That's what's wrong with me. I'm stomping people to death with my fucking feet. This,"
I swept out an arm,
"it's just totally fucking ridiculous, Alan. These people are 1 inch tall. It's like Gulliver beating the shit out of the Lilliputians."
"We don't get to choose our battles, John," Alan said.
"How does this battle make you feel?" I asked.
"It bothers me a little," Alan said. "It's not a stand-up fight at all. We're just blowing these people to hell. On the other hand, the worst casualty I have in my squad is a burst eardrum. That's a miracle for you right there. So overall, I feel pretty good about it. And the Kovandu aren't entirely helpless. The overall scoreboard between us and them is pretty much tied."
This was surprisingly true. The Kavandu's size worked to their advantage in space battles. Their ships are hard for hours to track, and their tiny fighter craft do little damage individually, but an immense amount in aggregate. It was only when it came to ground fights that we had the overwhelming advantage. Covabanda had a relatively small space fleet protecting it. It was one of the reasons the CDF decided to try to take it back.
"I'm not talking about who's ahead in the overall tally, Alan," I said. "I'm talking about the fact that our opponents are one fucking inch tall. Before this, we were fighting spiders. Before that, we were fighting goddamn pterodactyls. It's all messing with my sense of scale. It's messing with my sense of me. I don't feel human anymore, Alan."
"Technically speaking, you're not human anymore," Alan said. It was an attempt to lighten my mood. It didn't work.
"Well, then I don't feel connected with what it was to be human anymore," I said. "Our job is to go meet strange new people and cultures and kill the sons of bitches as quickly as we possibly can. We know only what we need to know about these people in order to fight with them. They don't exist to be anything other than an enemy as far as we know. Except for the fact that they're smart about fighting back, we might as well be fighting animals."
"Well, that makes it easier for most of us," Alan said. "If you don't identify with a spider, you don't feel as bad about killing one, even a big smart one. Maybe especially a big smart one."
"Maybe that's what's bothering me," I said. "There's no sense of consequence. I just took a living, thinking thing and hurled it into the side of a building. Doing it didn't bother me at all. That fact that it didn't does bother me, Alan. There ought to be consequences to our actions. We have to acknowledge at least some of the horror of what we do, whether we're doing it for good reasons or not. I have no horror about what I'm doing. I'm scared of that. I'm scared of what it means. I'm stomping around this city like a goddamn monster, and I'm beginning to think that's exactly what I am, what I've become. I'm a monster. You're a monster. We're all fucking inhuman monsters, and we don't see a damn thing wrong with it."
Alan didn't have anything to say to that. So instead we watched our soldiers stomping Kavandu to death, until finally there weren't really any left to stomp.
"So what the hell is wrong with him?"
Lieutenant Keyes asked Alan about me at the end of our post-battle briefing with the other squad leaders.
"He thinks we're all inhuman monsters," Alan said.
"Oh, that,"
Lieutenant Keyes said, and turned to me.
"How long have you been in, Perry?"
"Almost a year," I said.
Lieutenant Keyes nodded.
"You're right on schedule then, Perry. It takes about a year for most people to figure out they've turned into some soulless killing machine with no conscience or morals. Some sooner, some later. Jensen here," he indicated one of the other squadron leaders, "got to about the 15-month point before he cracked. Tell him what you did, Jensen."
"I took a shot at Keyes," Ron Jensen said, "seeing as he was the personification of the evil system that turned me into a killing machine."
"Nearly took off my head, too,"
Keyes said.
"It was a lucky shot," Jensen allowed.
"Yeah, lucky that you missed. Otherwise, I'd be dead and you'd be a brain floating in a tank, going insane from the lack of outside stimuli. Look, Perry, it happens to everyone. You'll shake it off when you realize you're not actually an inhuman monster. You're just trying to wrap your brain around a totally fucked up situation. For 75 years, you lead the sort of life where the most exciting thing that happens is you get laid from time to time, and the next thing you know, you're trying to blast space octopi with an MP before they kill you first. Christ, it's the ones that don't eventually lose it that I don't trust."
"Alan hasn't lost it," I said, "and he's been in as long as I have."
"Yeah, that's true," Keyes said. "What's your answer to that, Rosenthal?"
"I'm a seething cauldron of disconnected rage on the inside, Lieutenant."
"Ah, repression," Keyes said. "Excellent. Try to avoid taking a pot shot at me when you finally blow, please."
"I can't promise anything, sir," Alan said.
"You know, it worked for me,"
said Amy Weber, another squad leader.
I made a list of the things that I missed about Earth. It was sort of depressing, but on the other hand, it reminded me that I wasn't totally out of it. If you miss things, you're still connected.
So what did you miss? I asked.
Well, Shakespeare in the Park, for one, she said. My last night on Earth, I saw a production of Macbeth that was just perfection. God, that was great. And it's not like we're getting any good live theater around these here parts.
Yeah, I miss my daughter's chocolate chip cookies, said Jensen.
You can get chocolate chip cookies on the Modesto, Key said. Damn fine ones.
Yeah, they're not as good as my daughter's. The secret is molasses.
That sounds disgusting, Key said. I hate molasses.
Good thing I didn't know that when I shot at you, Jensen said. I wouldn't have missed.
Yeah, I miss swimming, said Greg Ridley. I used to swim in the river next to my property in Tennessee. Cold as hell most of the time, but I liked it that way.
Roller coasters, said Keyes. Big ones that made you feel like your intestines would drop out through your shoes.
Books, said Alan. A big, fat hardcover on a Sunday morning.
Well, Perry, Weber said. Anything you're missing right about now?
I shrugged.
Only one thing, I said. It can't be any stupider than missing roller coasters, Key said. Out with it. That's an order.
The only thing I really miss is being married, I said. I miss sitting around with my wife, just talking or reading together or whatever.
This got utter silence.
Well, that's a new one on me, Ridley said.
Shit, I don't miss that, Jensen said. The last 20 years of my marriage were nothing to write home about.
I looked around.
Don't any of you have spouses that joined up? Don't you keep in touch with them?
My husband signed up before I did, Weber said. He was already dead by the time I got my first posting.
My wife is stationed on the Boise, Key said. She drops me a note occasionally. I don't really get the feeling she's missing me terribly. I guess 38 years of me was enough.
People get out here and they don't really want to be in their old lives anymore, Jensen said. Sure, we missed the little things. Like Amy says, that's one of the ways you keep yourself from going nuts, but it's like being taken back in time to just before you made all the choices that gave you the life you had. If you could go back, why would you make the same choices? You already lived that life. My last comment aside, I don't regret the choices I made. But I'm not in a rush to make those same choices again. My wife's out here, sure, but she's happy to live her new life without me. And I must say, I'm not in a hurry to sign up on that tour of duty again either.
This isn't cheering me up, people, I said.
What is it about being married you miss? Alan asked.
Well, I miss my wife, you know, I said. But I also miss the feeling of, I don't know, comfort. The sense you're where you're supposed to be, with someone you're supposed to be with. I sure as hell don't feel that out here. We go places that we have to fight for, with people who might be dead the next day or the day after that. No offense.
None taken, Key said.
There's no stable ground out here, I said. There's nothing out here I feel really safe about. My marriage had its ups and downs, like anyone's, but when it came down to it, I knew it was solid. I missed that sort of security and that sort of connection with someone. Part of what makes us human is what we mean to other people and what people mean to us. I miss meaning something to someone, having that part of being human. That's what I miss about marriage.
More silence.
Well, hell, Perry, Ridley finally said. When you put it that way, I miss being married, too.
Jensen snorted.
I don't. You keep missing being married, Perry. I'll keep missing my daughter's cookies.
Molasses, Keyes said.
Disgusting.
Don't start that again, sir, Jensen said. I may have to go get my MP.
Susan's death was very nearly the flip side of Thomas's. A driller's strike on Elysium had severely reduced the amount of petroleum being refined. The Tucson was assigned to transport scab drillers and protect them while they got several of the shut-down drilling platforms back online. Susan was on one of the platforms when the striking drillers attacked with improvised artillery. The explosion knocked Susan and two other soldiers off the platform and down several dozen meters to the sea. The other two soldiers were already dead when they hit the water, but Susan, severely burned and barely conscious, was still alive. Susan was fished out of the sea by the striking drillers that had launched the attack. They decided to make an example of her. The Elysium Seas feature a large scavenger called a gaper, whose hinged jaw was easily capable of taking up a person in a single swallow. Gapers frequented the drilling platforms because they fed off the trash the platforms shed into the sea. The drillers propped Susan up, slapped her into consciousness, and then reeled off a hurried manifesto in her general direction, relying on her BrainPal connection to carry their words to the CDF. They then found Susan guilty of collaborating with the enemy, sentenced her to death, and pushed her back into the sea directly below the platform's trash chute. A gaper was not long in coming. One swallow and Susan was in. At this point, Susan was still alive and struggling to exit the gaper from the same orifice from which she entered. Before she could manage this, however, one of the striking drillers shot the gaper directly below the dorsal fin, where the animal's brain was located. The gaper was killed instantly and sank, taking Susan with it. Susan was killed, not from being eaten and not even from drowning, but from the pressure of the water as she and the fish that had swallowed her sank into the abyss. Any celebration by the striking drillers over this blow to the oppressor was short-lived. Fresh forces from the Tucson swept through the drillers' camps, rounded up several dozen ringleaders, shot them, and fed them all to the gapers. Except for the ones who killed Susan, who were fed to gapers without the intermediary step of being shot first. The strike ended shortly thereafter. Susan's death was clarifying to me, a reminder that humans can be as inhuman as any alien species. If I had been on the Tucson, I could see myself feeding one of the bastards that killed Susan to the gapers, and not feeling in the least bit bad about it. I don't know if this made me better or worse than what I had feared I was becoming when we battled the Kovandu, but I no longer worried about it making me any less human than I was before.
Chapter 12.
Those of us who were at Battle for Coral remember where we were when we first heard the planet had been taken. I was listening to Alan explain how the universe I thought I knew was long gone.
"We left it the first time we skipped," he said. "Just went up and out into the universe next door. That's how skipping works."
This got a nice, long, mute reaction from me and Ed McGuire, who were sitting with Alan in the battalion's at-ease lounge. Finally, Ed, who had taken over Amy Weber's squad, piped up,
"I'm not following you, Alan. I thought that the skip drive just took us up past the speed of light or something like that. That's how it works."
"Nope," Alan said.
"Einstein's still right. The speed of light is as fast as you can go, besides which you wouldn't want to start flying around the universe at any real fraction of the speed of light anyway. You hit even a little chunk of dirt while you're going a couple of 100,000 clicks a second, and you're going to put a pretty good hole in your spaceship. It's just a speedy way to get killed."
Ed blinked and then swept his hand over his head.
"Whoosh," he said. "You lost me."
"All right, look," Alan said. "You asked me how the skip drive works, and like I said, it's simple. It takes an object from one universe, like the Modesto, and pops it into another universe. The problem is that we refer to it as a drive. It's not really a drive at all, because acceleration is not a factor. The only factor is location within the multiverse."
"Alan," I said, "you're doing another flyby."
"Sorry," Alan said, and looked thoughtful for a second.
"How much math do you guys have?"
he asked.
I vaguely recall calculus, I said.
Ed McGuire nodded in agreement.
Ugh, Alan said.
Fine. I'm going to use small words here. Please don't be offended.
We'll try not to, Ed said.
Okay. First off, the universe you're in, the universe we're in right at this moment, is only one of an infinite number of possible universes whose existence is allowed for within quantum physics. Every time we spot an electron in a particular position, for example, our universe is functionally defined by that electron's position, while in the alternate universe, that electron's position is entirely different. You following me?
Not at all, said Ed.
You non-scientists. Well, just trust me on it, then. The point is, multiple universes. The multiverse. What the skip drive does is open a door to another one of those universes.
How does it do that? I asked.
You don't have the math for me to explain it to you, Alan said.
So it's magic, I said.
From your point of view, yes, Alan said. But it's well allowed in physics.
I don't get it, Ed said.
We've been through multiple universes then, yet in every universe we've been in has been exactly like ours. Every alternate universe I ever read about in science fiction has major differences. That's how you know you're in an alternate universe.
There's actually an interesting answer to that question, Alan said.
Let us take as a given that moving an object from one universe to another is a fundamentally unlikely event.
I can accept that, I said.
In terms of physics, this is allowable, since at its most basic level, this is a quantum physics universe and pretty much anything can happen, even if, as a practical matter, it doesn't. However, all other things being equal, each universe prefers to keep unlikely events to a bare minimum, especially above the subatomic level.
How does a universe prefer anything? Ed asked.
You don't have the math, Alan said.
Of course not, Ed said, rolling his eyes.
But the universe does prefer some things over others. It prefers to move towards a state of entropy, for example. It prefers to have the speed of light as a constant. You can modify or mess with these things to some extent, but they take work. Same thing here. In this case, moving an object from one universe to another is so unlikely that typically the universe to which you move the object is otherwise exactly like the one you left. A conservation of unlikeliness, you might say.
But how do you explain us moving from one place to another? I asked.
How do we get from one point in space in one universe to an entirely different point in space in another?
Well, think about it, Alan said.
Moving an entire ship into another universe is the incredibly unlikely part. From the universe's point of view, where in that new universe it appears is really very trivial. That's why I said that the word drive is a misnomer. We don't really go anywhere. We simply arrive.
And what happens in the universe that you just left? Asked Ed.
Another version of the Modesto from another universe pops right in, with alternate versions of us in it, Alan said.
Probably.
There's an infinitesimally small chance against it, but as a general rule, that's what happens.
So do we ever get to go back? I asked.
Back where? Alan said.
Back to the universes where we started from, I said.
No, Alan said. Well, again, it's theoretically possible you could, but it's extremely unlikely. Universes are continually being created from branching possibilities, and the universes we go to are generally created almost instantly before we skip into them. It's one of the reasons why we can skip to them. Because they are so very close to our own in composition. The longer in time you're separated from a particular universe, the more time it has to become divergent, and the less likely you are to go back to it. Even going back to a universe you left a second before is phenomenally unlikely. Going back to the one we left over a year ago, when we first skipped to Phoenix from Earth, is really out of the question.
I'm depressed, Ed said.
I liked my universe.
Well, get this, Ed, Alan said.
You don't even come from the same original universe as John and I, since you didn't make that first skip when we did. What's more, even the people who did make that same first skip with us aren't in the same universe as us now, since they've since skipped into different universes because they're on different ships. Any versions of our old friends that we meet up with will be alternate versions. Of course, they will look and act the same,
because, except for the occasional electron placement here and there, they are the same, but our originating universes are completely different.
So, you and I are all that's left of our universe, I said.
It's a pretty good bet that universe continues to exist, Alan said, but we are almost certainly the only two people from it in this universe.
I don't know what to think about that, I said.
Try not to let it worry you too much, Alan said. From a day-to-day point of view, all this universe hopping doesn't matter. Functionally speaking, everything is pretty much the same no matter what universe you're in.
So why do we need starships at all? Ed asked.
Quite obviously, to get where you're going once you're in your new universe, Alan said.
No, Ed said. I mean, if you can just pop from one universe to another, why not just do it planet to planet, instead of using spaceships at all? Just skip people directly to a planet's surface. It'd save us from getting shot up in space, that's for sure.
The universe prefers to have skipping done away from large gravity wells like planets and stars, Alan said. Particularly when skipping to another universe, you can skip very close to a gravity well, which is why we enter new universes near our destinations, but skipping out is much easier the farther away you are from one, which is why we always travel a bit before we skip. There's actually an exponential relationship which I could show you, but...
Yeah, I know, I don't have the math, Ed said.
Alan was about to provide a placating response when all of our brain pals flicked on. The Modesto had just received news of the Coral Massacre, and in whatever universe you were in, it was horrifying stuff. Coral was the fifth planet humans settled, and the first one that was indisputably better acclimated for humans than even Earth itself. It was geologically stable, with weather systems that spread a temperate growing zone across most of its generous landmasses, and laden with native plant and animal species genetically similar enough to Earth's that they fulfilled human nutritional and aesthetic needs. Early on, there was talk of naming the colony Eden, but it was suggested that such a name was karmically tantamount to asking for trouble. Coral was chosen instead for the coral-like creatures that created gloriously diverse island archipelagos and undersea reefs around the planet's equatorial tropical zone. Human expansion on coral was uncharacteristically kept to minimum, and those humans who did live there largely chose to live in a simple, almost pre-industrial way. It was one of the few places in the universe where humans attempted to adapt to the existing ecosystem, rather than plow it over and introduce, say, corn and cattle. And it worked. The human presence, small and accommodating, dovetailed into coral's biosphere and thrived in a modest and controlled way. It was therefore entirely unprepared for the arrival of the RA invasion force, which carried in its numbers a 1-to-1 ratio of soldiers to colonists. The garrison of CDF troops stationed above and on Coral put up a brief but valiant fight before being overwhelmed. The colonists likewise made the RA pay for their attack. In short order, however, the colony was laid waste and the surviving colonists literally butchered, as the RA had long ago developed a taste for human meat when they could get it. One of the snippets broadcast to us via BrainPal was a segment of an intercepted food program in which one of the RA's most famous celebrity chefs discussed the best way to carve up a human for multiple food uses, neck bones being particularly prized for soups and consommés. In addition to sickening us, the video was anecdotal proof that the Coral Massacre was planned in enough detail that they brought along even second-rate RA celebrities to take part in the festivities. Clearly, the RA were planning to stay. The RA wasted no time toward their primary goal for the invasion. After all the colonists had been killed, the RA transported down platforms to begin strip-mining Coral's islands. The RA had previously tried to negotiate with the colonial government to mine the islands. Coral-like reefs had been extensive on the RA homeworld until a combination of industrial pollution and commercial mining had destroyed them. The colonial government refused permission for mining, both because of Coral's colonists' wishes to keep the planet whole and because the RA's anthropophagic tendencies were well known. No one wanted the RA overflying the colonies, looking for unsuspecting humans to turn into jerky. The colonial government's failing was in not recognizing what a priority the RA had made coral mining. Beyond its commerce, there was a religious aspect involved that colonial diplomats grossly misinterpreted, or the lengths that the RA were willing to go to undertake the operation. The RA and the colonial government had mixed it up a few times. Relations were never good. How comfortable can you really be with a race that sees you as a nutritious part of a complete breakfast? By and large, however, they kept to their knitting and we to ours. It was only now, as the last of the RA's native coral reefs choked toward extinction, that the extent of their desire for coral's resources came to slug us in the face. Coral was theirs, and we'd have to hit them harder than they had hit us to get it back.
It's pretty fucking grim,
Lieutenant Keyes was telling the squad leaders.
And it's going to be grimmer by the time we get there.
We were in the platoon ready room, cups of coffee growing cold as we accessed page upon page of atrocity reports and surveillance information from the coral system. What skip drones weren't blasted from the sky by the RA reported back a continuing stream of inbound RA ships, both for battle and for hauling coral. In less than 2 days after the coral massacre, almost 1,000 RA ships hovered in the space above the planet, waiting to begin their predation in earnest.
"Here's what we know,"
Key said, and popped up a graphic of the coral system in our brain pals.
"We estimate that the largest portion of RA ship activity in the coral system is commercial and industrial. From what we know of their ship design, about a quarter of the ships, 300 or so, have military-grade offensive and defensive capabilities, and many of those are troop transports with minimal shielding and firepower. But the ones that are battleship class are both larger and tougher than our equivalent ships. We also estimate up to 100,000 RA forces on the surface, and they've begun to entrench for invasion. They're expecting us to fight for coral, but our best intelligence suggests they expect us to launch an attack in 4 to 6 days, the amount of time it will take us to maneuver enough of our big ships into skip position. They know CDF prefers to make overwhelming displays of force, and that is going to take us some time.
So when are we going to attack? Alan asked.
About 11 hours from now, Keyes said.
We all shifted uncomfortably in our chairs.
How can that work, sir? Ron Jensen asked. The only ships we'll have available are those that are already at skip distance, or those that will be in the next few hours. How many of those can there be?
62, counting the Modesto, Keyes said.
And our brain pals downloaded the list of available ships. I briefly noted the presence of the Hampton Roads in the list. That was the ship to which Harry and Jesse were posted.
6 more ships are increasing speed to reach skip distance, but we can't count on them to be there when we strike.
Christ, Keyes, said Ed McGuire. That's 5 to 1 on the ships and 2 to 1 on ground forces, assuming we can land them all. I think I like our tradition of overwhelming force better.
By the time we have enough big ships in line to slug it out, they'll be ready for us, Keyes said. We're better off sending in a smaller force while they're unprepared and doing as much damage as possible right now. There will be a larger force in 4 days, 200 ships, packing heat. If we do our job right, they'll have short work of whatever remains of the RA forces.
Ed snorted. Not that we'll be around to appreciate it. Keyes smiled tightly.
Such lack of faith. Look, people, I know this isn't a happy hike on the moon, but we're not going to be stupid about this. We're not going to slug it out toe to toe. We're going to come in with targeted goals. We're going to hit troop transports on the way in to keep them from bringing in additional ground troops. We're going to land troops to disrupt mining operations before they get going and make it hard for the RA to target us without hitting their own troops and equipment. We'll hit commercial and industrial craft as opportunities present themselves, and we'll attempt to draw the big guns out of coral orbit. So when our reinforcements arrive, we'll be in front and behind them.
"I'd like to go back to the part about the ground troops," Alan said. "We're landing troops, and then our ships are going to try to draw Array ships away? What does that mean for us ground troops, what I think it does?" Keyes nodded. "We'll be cut off for at least 3 or 4 days."
"Swell," Jensen said.
"It's war, you jackasses," Keyes snapped. "I'm sorry it's not terribly convenient or comfortable for you."
"What happens if the plan doesn't work and our ships are shot out of the sky?" I asked.
"Well, then I suppose we're fucked, Perry," Keyes said. "But let's not go in with that assumption. We're professionals. We have a job to do. This is what we're trained for. The plan has risks, but they're not stupid risks. And if it works, we'll have the planet back and have done serious damage to the RA. Let's all go on the assumption we're going to make a difference. What do you say? It's a nutty idea, but it just might work. And if you get behind it, the chances of it working are that much better, all right?"
More shifting in chairs. We weren't entirely convinced, but there was little to be done. We were going in whether we liked it or not.
"Those 6 ships that might make it to the party," Jensen said. "Who are they?"
Keyes took a second to access the information.
"The Little Rock, the Mobile, the Waco, the Muncie, the Burlington, and the Sparrowhawk," he said.
"The Sparrowhawk?" Jensen said. "No shit!"
"What about the Sparrowhawk?" I asked.
The name was unusual. Battalion-strength spaceships were traditionally named after mid-sized cities.
"Ghost Brigades, Perry," Jensen said. "CDF Special Forces, industrial-strength motherfuckers."
"I've never heard of them before," I said. Actually, I thought I had at some point, but the when and where escaped me.
"The CDF saves them for special occasions," Jensen said. "They don't play nice with others. It'd be nice to have them there when we got onto the planet, though. Save us the trouble of dying."
"It'd be nice, but it's probably not going to happen," Keyes said. "This is our show, boys and girls, for better or worse."
The Modesto skipped into Coral Orbital Space 10 hours later, and in its first few seconds of arrival was struck by 6 missiles fired at close range by a RA battlecruiser. The Modesto's aft starboard engine array shattered, sending the ship wildly tumbling ass overhead. My squad and Allen's were packed into a transport shuttle when the missiles hit. The force of the blast's sudden inertial shift slammed several of our soldiers into the sides of the transport. In the shuttle bay, loose equipment and material were flung across the bay, striking one of the other transports, but missing ours. The shuttles, locked down by electromagnets, thankfully stayed put. I activated asshole to check ship status. The Modesto was severely damaged, and active scanning by the RA ship indicated it was lining up for another series of missiles.
"It's time to go,"
I yelled to Fiona Eaton, our pilot.
"I don't have clearance from control," she said.
"In about 10 seconds we're going to get hit by another volley of missiles," I said. "There's your fucking clearance."
Fiona growled. Alan, who was also plugged into Modesto mainframe, yelled from the back.
"Missiles away," he said. 26 seconds to impact."
"Is that enough time to get out?"
I asked Fiona.
"We'll see,"
she said, and opened a channel to the other shuttles. "This is Fiona Eaton, piloting Transport 6. Be advised, I will perform emergency bay door procedure in 3 seconds. Good luck." She turned to me.
"Strap in now,"
she said, and punched a red button. The bay doors were outlined with a sharp shock of light. The crack of the doors blasting away was lost in the roar of escaping air as the doors tumbled out. Everything not strapped down launched out the hole. Beyond the debris, the starfield lurched sickeningly as the Modesto spun. Fiona fed thrust to the engines and waited just long enough for the debris to clear the bay door before cutting the electromagnetic tethers and launching the shuttle out the door. Fiona compensated for the Modesto's spin as she exited, but just barely. We scraped the roof going out. I accessed the launch bay's video feed. Other shuttles were blasting out of the bay doors by 2s and 3s. 5 made it out before the second volley of missiles crashed into the ship, abruptly changing the trajectory of the Modesto's spin and smashing several shuttles already hovering into the shuttle bay floor. At least 1 exploded. Debris struck the camera and knocked it out.
Cut your brain pal feed to the Modesto, Fiona said. They can use it to track us. Tell your squads, verbally.
I did.
Alan came forward.
We've got a couple of minor wounds back there, he said, motioning to our soldiers. But nothing too serious. What's the plan?
I've got us headed toward Coral and I've cut the engines, Fiona said. They're probably looking for thrust signatures and brain pal transmissions to lock missiles on. So as long as we look dead, they might leave us alone long enough for us to get into the atmosphere.
Might?
Alan said. If you've got a better plan, I'm all ears, Fiona said.
I have no idea what's going on, Alan said. So I'm happy to go with your plan.
What the hell happened back there anyway? Fiona said. They hit us as we came out of skip drive. There's no way they could have known where we would be.
Maybe we were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, Alan said.
I don't think so, I said, and pointed out the window.
Look.
I pointed to our array battlecruiser to port that was sparkling as missiles thrust away from the cruiser. At extreme starboard, a CDF cruiser popped into existence. A few seconds later, the missiles connected, hitting the CDF cruiser broadside.
No fucking way, Fiona said.
They know exactly where our ships are coming out, Alan said. It's an ambush.
How the fuck are they doing that? Fiona demanded.